From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now. Witnesses are continuing to testify today in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd. Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross, was the first to take the stand. She testified that she and Floyd struggled with opioid addictions brought on by chronic pain. Tears streamed down her face as Ross described, quote, a classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids. Here she is.
We both had prescriptions, but after prescriptions that were filled and we got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction many times.
NPR's Cheryl Corley is in Minneapolis covering the trial and joins us now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
So Ross said that before Floyd's death, she suspected he was using drugs again after they had both quit for quite a while. Tell us about her testimony.
Well, you know, she talked about George Floyd and what prosecutors like to call spark of life testimony, where they can have people detail how a person lived, who he or she was, to give jurors a better idea of who the person is. Yesterday, jurors got to see Floyd talking to people, being a regular customer in a grocery store. And today, they really got a chance to learn from him, from his girlfriend, Courtney Ross. So she talked about how they met at a Salvation Army shelter in 2017. She called him sweet, that he had asked her if they could pray together when she appeared distraught when they first met. So they eventually ended up in this relationship for about 3 years, and she talked about how he liked to work out, lifting weights, exercising, liked sports, especially football, and playing sports with kids. So it was a chance to see Floyd in a much different light. But she also talked about how they both suffered, as you mentioned, with opioid addiction, and I think that was, you know, something that the prosecution wanted to do, was to put that issue front and center to show that they weren't going to ignore George Floyd's problem with drugs. And so Ross talked about how they both got hooked using prescription opioids for pain and continuing that drug use off and on throughout their relationship.
So, yeah, it was a nuanced portrait, but overall, spark of life, I think, is a good way to describe it. After the prosecution had a chance, then the Chauvin defense attorney, Eric Nelson, had an opportunity to cross-examine Ross, and she testified that Floyd was hospitalized for an overdose a couple of months before his death. Now, it's worth remembering here that Floyd is not the one on trial here, but he has been the main subject of today's court session, Cheryl. So what was the Chauvin defense team trying to accomplish with its line of questioning about Floyd?
Well, the defense attorney, Eric Nelson, he had indicated early on in his opening statements that former police officer Derek Chauvin, who's on trial here, did what he was trained to do, that it wasn't his knee on George Floyd's neck that caused Floyd's death, but rather Floyd's illegal drug use, along with heart disease and high blood pressure. At least that's the argument. So he had specific questions about Ross and Floyd's drug use, and about the time, as you mentioned, when Floyd was hospitalized, apparently for a drug overdose, how that might have progressed to heroin. So he was essentially laying the groundwork for arguments that we're likely to hear much more of when the defense actually presents its case.
Cheryl, so far we've had more than a dozen witnesses called already by the prosecution. How many more do we expect?
Well, we don't have a specific number. There could be many more. After Ross, prosecutors called one of the paramedics who arrived on the scene on May 25th. But both sides have hundreds of possible witnesses. They may include experts talking about the use of force. The Minneapolis police chief is reportedly on tap for tomorrow. We're going to hear from medical experts, too, who will talk about George Floyd's death and yeah, their opinions about how and why he passed away.
Plenty more to come. NPR's Cheryl Corley in Minneapolis. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Well, a number of technology companies and nonprofits are working to develop secure ways to share COVID-19 test results and vaccination status. This week, New York launched a free, voluntary digital platform called the Excelsior Pass. It was developed with IBM, and it can be used at theaters, stadiums, and other venues that want to reopen to large crowds. New York is the first state to launch something like this, but there's sure to be more. Jason Kelly is a general manager at IBM, and he joins me now. Jason, welcome.
Hello, Peter. Glad to join you. Hope you are doing well.
I'm doing well, and thank you so much for asking. Now, listen, we're hearing a lot about vaccine passports across the country. Is that what this is?
It is, in fact, a vaccine credential. It's just another tool in the toolbox to offer ways for people to share on their merit, their health status, really a capability to enable the power of privacy, your privacy, Peter, and put it in your hands, in this case, literally, right, in the form of an app, a secure app.
So how have the last few days gone since the rollout started in New York? Are people using it? Are businesses using it?
We have lots of people using it. The feedback is, instead of carrying a piece of paper, I now have something that I can show to validate that either A, I've been tested and I'm negative, or that I have been vaccinated. So it's optional, it's accessible, it's easy to use. The feedback is it's intuitive and it's scalable. It's working well across multiple types of technology. So think of it as a platform of capability. So that's the positive feedback that we've been hearing and seeing across the board.
What about the negative feedback?
Well, I'd say all feedback is a gift. And the feedback that we're getting is that people want to make sure their data is their data. And the question that comes up, and I want your listeners to know that there's no health data that's being collected, shared, stored. It's simply a QR code in this app that then allows them to use it the way they see fit.
So you're saying that the federal government, the state government of New York, any government is not going to have any personal information or access to personal information if I have this app on my phone?
Not through the app. Now, we do know that many states do collect vaccination information. Those records exist. So we're not changing any of that. But when you, Peter, decide to share that you've been vaccinated, it's just a QR code. It's not just if you have a phone. This has to be equitable and make sure we're being inclusive. So you can print it as well. So that QR code can be printed.
I feel like dawn is starting to emerge on this strange new world that we're living in. So I need you to describe just a little bit more about how this works. If someone has been vaccinated and you get that information, that paper card from the CDC that they give you after that shot, how does that get into your digital app? And how can you be sure, you, the maker of this app, that it's real, that I'm not putting in false information?
That's the beauty. And as you say it, I'm flipping my CDC card right in my hand. And this app allows that information to be pushed to your smart device. And so now having that digital capability allows you to have access and hopefully return to those places that you're used to going, your workplace, or in the case of the state of New York, a sporting event at Barclays Stadium where they piloted, or even it was Madison Square Garden where they piloted for a second time, just to ensure that it was ready to launch as they have this week.
The Washington Post is reporting that there are at least 17 initiatives like this ramping up across the country. Is it possible that we're about to open up a very confusing situation here in which every state, every restaurant, every airline is using a different platform?
The beauty in what we're talking about right now, Peter, is a common platform that allows multiple capabilities to be integrated and used interchangeably. We're not just doing this in the U.S. We're working with Common Pass, with the Vaccine Credential Initiative. This is a global opportunity. And as some would say, it is the data puzzle for us to solve in our lifetime.
You're saying they would be able to talk with each other so that they could communicate back and forth with one another?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, already, as you know, there are plenty of debates going on about these passes. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said this week that it's unacceptable for the government to require proof of vaccination just simply to be able to participate in normal society. We got to point out that New York's Excelsior Pass is voluntary. The state is not making it a requirement. But do you think that this is just going to create another conflict? A conflict like we've seen with masks and other things during this pandemic that people are going to be arguing about and making political?
Peter, I'll leave the arguments and the politics with the policymakers. We want to do, from an IBM perspective, is what we've always done when it was time to put a person on the moon and bring them home again, is focus on innovation that matters for us and the world.
Jason Kelly, a general manager at IBM, talking about this vaccine credential or passport that's just been launched in New York State. Jason, thanks for your time.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Much of our national conversation about the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border centers on crowded holding facilities and the chaotic process there. But President Biden said last week that he's directed Vice President Harris to focus on, quote, the fundamental reasons why people leave Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador in the first place. The BBC's Will Grant was in Guatemala recently to report on this very issue, trying to understand why many people are so desperate to get to America. And he joins us from Mexico City on Skype. Will, you went to a village called Nueva Esperanza. What did you find there?
Nueva Esperanza, Callum, is a tiny little place. It's outside a place called Comitancillo, and it's really just a collection of shacks in many ways. But standing out as you drive into the town along this dirt road are some very well-finished, elaborate homes. And essentially, those were the homes that were paid for by remittances of family members who'd made it up north. And that, for the family that I went to see in Nueva Esperanza, was like a daily temptation for the youngest members, particularly a lad called Anderson, who was just 16. And he had already left, and I was back there. I was there at his family home when he was back there in, frankly, the worst possible way. They had received his remains after he was murdered on the journey north, part of a group of 16 immigrants who were, unfortunately, in Tamaulipas, one of the most dangerous states in northern Mexico, just miles from the U.S. border, were shot, murdered, and their bodies set on fire. An absolutely horrific tale. But it showed to me that they were prepared to take those risks, to risk that kind of outcome, to leave the kind of poverty they were living in Nueva Esperanza and the towns around there.
Yeah, it's just a heartbreaking story, Will. And as you say, the people there, they can see the potential reward for somebody who does make it to the United States and is able to send money back to their relatives. But then Anderson's story really just underscores the very high risk. And I know that you spoke with his father, Marco, and he told you that he knew he shouldn't let his son go, but on the other hand, he couldn't tie him down to the bed. And I want to just listen to a little bit of your conversation with him.
Digamos, todo joven tiene derecho a la vida.
So what he's saying there in Mayan, Will, is that as a parent, you have to give your kids the chance for a better life. And I know that Anderson's younger brother, I think just 14, told you that he also is going to leave home, just like his brother did, even though he's seen what can happen.
Yeah, that I think was the point that stood out most to me, the idea that a younger brother, just 14, would be prepared to, as he put it, sort of finish his brother's journey. We went to the main town that the majority of the migrants were from, Comitancillo. We went to see their soccer team. And on average, at least half of the players there will leave to make the journey, will attempt at the very least, even if they don't make it to the United States. And again, one of the members of the team was among the group who had died. We went to see his mother. And it was clear that at his tender age of sort of 21, 22, he was supporting a huge network of family, you know, both of his sisters, his ill mother, his sister's children. He was just literally the only breadwinner. And he was working the field for the equivalent of $3, $4, at most $5 a day.
That's the BBC's Will Grant bringing us the latest from his reporting in Guatemala, where he is seeing the conditions that are driving so many people to make that risky journey up to the United States. Will joined us from Mexico City. Thank you, Will.
You're welcome, Callum. Thanks.
Over the next 4 years, Guatemala and other Central American countries could be getting billions of dollars from the U.S. government as part of President Biden's plan to help stem the flow of migrants fleeing the region. But will it work? Former Costa Rican President Luis Guillermo Solis says maybe. He's now the director of the Kimberly Green Latin America and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. President Solis, welcome.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And as we just heard in that piece there from Guatemala, there are many reasons why Central Americans are coming to the United States. One of the main push factors, of course, has always been the economy. How bad have economic conditions been in the region in the past year?
They have been pretty bad, and particularly because of climate issues. There were two Category 5 hurricanes that hit Honduras, El Salvador, a bit of Guatemala in late November, plus the COVID pandemic, which destroyed the economies. It is going to take at least a couple of years for the economies to recuperate. You have to remember that most of our economies still are very much determined by agricultural goods, and they were particularly hard hit by the pandemic because of labor conditions and the weather, of course.
Yeah. So you've laid out some specific areas that you would like the $4 billion from the Biden administration to target. Where would you start, and what would you tell the Vice President, Kamala Harris, who will be in charge of this project?
Well, I think she should listen to her advisor. She has a phenomenal group of people. There is ample experience in the past. The aid should be targeted. It should not be spread around in equal amounts. You know, it has to go to areas that are being hit by different kinds of phenomena. So you have, you know, either droughts or flooding or earthquakes, or you have lack of jobs or juvenile work or work with women that's necessary. If you take that approach, it is likely that the impact is going to be significant in some countries.
U.S. administrations have been sending money to Central America for decades. It did decline during the Trump era. Many would argue also that U.S. interference in the region has historically been one of the reasons that local governments have destabilized. Is it safe to say that our investments haven't solved this problem?
Well, it is partially true, and it is fair to say so. But the truth of the matter is that we don't have to be hypocritical here. The American aid is never going to solve the problems that Central American elites and the Central American political systems ought to resolve by themselves. And I say this because there's a lot of blame that's put on the United States, and I always wonder, what about the people who don't pay taxes back home? Or what about those who have been accumulating land without giving the opportunity to peasants? You know, these are Central American groups that have profited from the poverty of their fellow citizens. So, yes, many times the United States has been part of the injustice that has prevailed, but the United States is not to blame. I mean, there are structural factors that come from back in time, and I think the Central American elites are responsible for them.
When you say that, it reminds me of the last election in Honduras, 2018. It was shaping up to be an opposition landslide. Maybe you remember this. The power suddenly went out nationwide, and then when it came back on hours later, the president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, had impossibly become the winner. So on the issue of corruption, how do you think foreign money can make a difference when there is such major problems at the top levels of government? Who can trust that the money is going to be going into the right pockets?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think that most of the money that's provided by foreign governments is well administered because the conditions upon which the money is given are very strict. So USAID, the European Union, you know, they put a lot of attention in how the money is spent. But the monies of the countries and the way in which they have been handled by the ruling elites, private sector elites as well sometimes, are to be looked in under a different light. This is why commissions such as the Anti-Corruption and Pro-Transparency Commission in Guatemala, CICIG and MASI in Honduras and others, and now the task force that the U.S. government has announced it will create are so important. I mean, let's remember, there's a fugitive former president of El Salvador, who has received diplomatic coverage in Nicaragua as a political asylee, who embezzled $350 million from El Salvador's treasury. I mean, with this kind of corruption, it's impossible to progress. And that has to be in the agenda, of course.
Is it true that in many cases, the money from foreign countries like the United States isn't even used?
Sometimes it is not used because the agencies that are given the money don't have the administrative capacity to do so. Or, like it was the case during the Trump administration, the United States puts a halt on the assistance due to political reasons. So you have a number of issues, either having to do with controls or having to do with politics, or even the impossibility of spending money during a fiscal cycle. You know, the money is to be spent in 1 year, and simply because of the nature of the problems being structural, it requires more than that, and therefore the money is not lost, but is taken away and allocated in a different way.
Hmm. I live in a border state. I've spoken with many migrants at the border over the years, and I don't think, Mr. President, that any of them have ever been from your home country of Costa Rica. Now, of course, I know there are some, but this is very interesting to me. Your country has been an outlier of stability in Central America for many years. Do we have lessons to learn from that?
Well, definitely the fact that there are not as many Costa Ricans as any other migrants into the United States says something about the system that we've developed through the years. You know, it's a welfare state. We're now having issues with it, and we've had many Costa Ricans come to the United States to work here for a while, but then generally they go back. And I think this has to do with the nature of the regime, the fairness of the economy, the building up of a middle class. People don't happily leave their country. They don't want to be a millionaire, but they have to have certain services, education, health, housing, jobs. If this is the case, most of the migrants would not come. And I think that in many ways, that is what the Costa Rican example shows.
Former Costa Rican President Luis Guillermo Solis, now director of the Kimberly Green Latin America and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. Thanks for taking some time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
After immense public pressure, the heads of two of the biggest companies in Georgia are speaking out against a new restrictive voting law signed by the governor last week. Delta CEO Ed Bastian initially made vague statements in support of voting rights, but didn't directly condemn the law. Yesterday he did, calling it unacceptable. And here's how Coca-Cola CEO James Quincy described the law on CNBC yesterday.
It is a step backwards, and it does not promote principles we have stood for in Georgia.
That may not be enough because activists are planning to boycott these companies, which have kept quiet as Republican lawmakers passed what many are describing as a return to the Jim Crow era. Let's bring in Ali Velshi. He's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello. Good to talk to you again.
Good to have you. So there's also pressure coming from outside the state from several black Fortune 500 executives. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp responded to them on CNBC yesterday.
They don't even know what the laws are in Georgia. And quite honestly, our laws are not as restrictive as their own states where they're residing. So perhaps they should focus in other places.
So a little tit for tat here. Why is all of this happening after the law was already passed?
Well, there's a frustration from a number of quarters. One is that American businesses moved fairly quickly on Black Lives Matter stuff last year. And many of them didn't need to be coaxed to do so. But for some reason, these voter restrictions that are taking place in Georgia and in other places like Arizona and Iowa and Michigan, for some reason, corporations weren't as fast to condemn it. And particularly since there are so many large corporations based in Atlanta, Coca-Cola, Home Depot, Delta, UPS and others, there was a sense that they didn't handle this right off the top. Now, these black leaders that Brian Kemp was talking about, there's 72 or 73 of them. I'm not sure what he's talking about, that they don't know what the laws are in Georgia. This has been fairly well reported out. But there is pressure on these companies to do more than they've already done, and pressure from protesters and pressure from Georgia to say, don't get involved in our politics. Obviously, for the Georgia-based companies like Delta, like UPS, like Home Depot, the pressure is more intense because workers for those companies are based in Georgia.
So what's next? There's now talk of Major League Baseball taking this year's All-Star game out of Atlanta. Is there going to be more of an impact beyond these statements from Delta and Coca-Cola?
Yeah, I think what happened is initially the legislation that was going through the Georgia State Legislature wasn't clear to everybody that there might have been racial undertones to it. The bottom line is Georgia has been operating under the laws that it's been operating under for a while, and it was quite satisfactory to the governor and members of the legislature, largely because Georgia tended to vote Republican all the time. All of a sudden, there was a lot of voter turnout in the last election. It favored Democrats at the presidential level and the two Senate seats that went blue. And as a result, they are changing these laws. So it feels like they might be targeted toward Democrats generally, but African-American voters in particular. So it does seem that this is gaining momentum and that the companies may have to take the lead in saying to Georgia Republicans, we won't finance you, we won't contribute to your coffers, and we may not get involved with you if you don't change the law. So the momentum does seem to be on the part of those people who are fighting for stronger voters' rights in Georgia.
All right. Ali Belshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks very much for your insights. We do appreciate it.
Let's check in on efforts to overhaul voting in the U.S. Overnight, state lawmakers in Texas advanced a bill to limit extended early voting hours, ban drive-through voting, and make it illegal to proactively send ballots by mail to voters. And the state of Georgia is now facing three different lawsuits over restrictions to voting that were signed into law last week. Supporters of laws like these say they want to protect election integrity. Critics say people of color will be disproportionately hurt. The Brennan Center for Justice has found lawmakers in almost every state have proposed changes to voting rules, including 361 bills to restrict voting access and 843 to expand them. Here to talk about it, in part one of a series on voting, is Mirna Perez. She's the director of voting rights and elections at the Brennan Center for Justice. And Mirna, let's begin in Georgia, where in future elections, ballot drop boxes will be limited, early voting hours curtailed, IDs will be required for absentee voting, and it'll be a crime to provide food or water to anybody standing in line to vote. So where does Georgia's new law rank on the scale of new voting restrictions in your estimation?
Georgia's new laws rank pretty high on a scale of voting restrictions, in large part because Georgia already has a restricted system in many ways. And this is in the face of a political upset. There was massive turnout. There were changes that happened in the election in terms of who is getting sent to the Senate. And rather than recognizing that the voters of Georgia want something different, we have some politicians trying to put barriers in front of the ballot box and inventing things that didn't go wrong and, frankly, retaliating in many ways against the things that most Americans think are good, right? Like, it is good for people to be waiting in line when the line is long. I mean, they shouldn't have a long line, but if there is a long line, they should care enough about the right to vote to be able to wait. And to just make it comfortable for people to be able to do that is something that most Americans would think is fine and makes sense. And instead, we're seeing all these reactions to try and deter and discourage and disenfranchise people. And I think it's this very clear and unmistakable reaction to a political outcome that the people who are currently currently in power in the legislature are trying to stop that is just really capturing America's attention. Like, it is so obvious that this is a response to what happened in the Senate.
We, of course, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff were both elected as Democrats in a big upset, as you said. Georgia is one of the states where we have seen the bill actually make it all the way through the legislature and be signed into law. But an analysis by the news site 538 concluded that actually most of the bills across the country to restrict voting are not likely to pass. So I'm wondering whether it's an exaggeration to say that they represent the biggest rollback in voting rights since the end of Reconstruction, since it may not actually happen.
I think there's a couple of points that are relevant to remember. One, we saw a giant, massive rollback after 2010, where there were reactions to a historic election of an African-American president, and the state houses changed. And so we are already starting from a place where 19 states after the 2010 election had made it harder for people to vote. So the reaction we're seeing now is very much looking like the kind of pushback we saw then. And I think the concern is the animating interest, right? Yes, most of these bills are not going to pass, but like the Georgia bill is not just one bill. It's got a bunch of different components of it. And when the last time we saw something like this, we ended up seeing 19 states pass more restrictive bills. And at a time where the voters made very clear that they care about voting, and they made this clear by showing up to vote in record numbers, notwithstanding the fact that we're in a once-in-a-century pandemic, instead of riding that wave and making all the reforms more permanent that we saw to accommodate voters during the pandemic, we see people pushing them back. So I think the numbers are indicative of a mood. They're indicative of an effort. Nobody believes that all 300 and change bills are going to pass, but the ones that are passing are significant and are problematic and are compounding a problem that we saw in 2010 that has been further compounded with the fact that the Supreme Court issued a decision in 2013 that lifted some federal guardrails on what states could do to suppress voters. So I think this is a time of high alert, and one should not get overly fixated on the numbers, except for they indicate an effort and a passion and a zeal for rolling back access.
Let me ask you then about a couple of arguments that you'll hear from Republicans on this issue. One is that the effort at the federal level to push through a new voting rights bill on what could be a party line vote is insane. That was the words of Mark Braden, the former chief counsel to the Republican National Committee. And he says that you have a lot of Republican voters who already don't trust the process. And so to have a partisan a bill would just further alienate them. And then more broadly, Myrna, I mean, many Republicans say the Democrats are trying to pull a bait and switch here. In other words, they baited GOP lawmakers with expansions like no excuse mail-in voting to address the special circumstance of the pandemic last year. And now they say Democrats are trying to switch those temporary changes into permanent ones. Are those fair criticisms?
So let's break them down. Let's do the last one first. Elections should be dynamic, right? We should be learning from things that happen. We should be assessing what went right and what went wrong in one election, and then using and importing those lessons to further elections. We were able to make these reforms. People were able to turn out. We had an election that, even the prior administration in their formal way said was safe and secure. And the processes in the states worked about as well as they could for voters. So I think it's not a bait and switch. It's a, look, you were nervous. We tried it out on a temporary basis. Now what's the justification for making these changes more permanent, except for you don't want people to use them because people just are opposed to the idea of making our elections as accessible as possible.
I just want to point out, we almost can't say enough that the distrust that some voters feel toward the process is rooted on falsehoods about the way the last election went. I feel like we should underscore that one more time.
Right. Well, and also falsehoods perpetrated by some of the very politicians that are now trying to push these bills. Like, it's inappropriate and gross that we have some politicians that spent a lot of the last year spreading misinformation and disinformation and falsehoods, and then are now saying, oh, our constituents believed us, so now we have to do all these anti-voter efforts because they're now concerned, right? Like, you know, I've not met a politician that is sitting in office that says that we shouldn't trust the outcome of the election in which she or he won. Right. Like nobody says that, you know, they were improperly elected because of any wrongdoing. It's always somebody else's election.
So, Myrna, we've talked about some of the high profile battles over voting rights at the federal level and in states like Texas and Georgia. I'm curious if there's an under the radar state that you think we should be paying closer attention to right now.
I do think that we need to be paying attention to all of the states in which elections are being less accessible. I mean, folks are fixated on the battleground states, but I think that that is a mistake. I think we should be recognizing that our neighbors and our country are better off when all of us are participating and all of us are voting. It makes me sad to hear that, you know, the money and the attention, et cetera, is going to the places that are the most high profile because people think it can swing an election. We instead need to be asking the question, what kind of country do we want to be? And do we want to be a country where every American is able to participate? And if that's the case, then we need to be looking for things like the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act to make sure that voters are going to enjoy some basic federal protections and some basic minimum standards irrespective of where they live.
That's Myrna Perez. She directs the Voting Rights and Elections Division at the Brennan Center for Justice, which is keeping track of efforts at the state level to either expand or restrict ballot access after the 2020 election. Myrna, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Drive-in concerts, online fundraisers, and rehearsals via Zoom. That's the new reality of producing art just over a year into COVID-19. But just how many of these changes will stick around once the pandemic is over? Chloe Veltman from member station KQED in San Francisco checked in with the Bay Area performing arts community and has this story.
A year into the pandemic, and I finally got to see a live show.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to very experimental COVID-era theater.
This piece of live theater put on by the Oakland Theater Project was a drive-in experience. We all sat in our cars as the voice of actor William Oliver III was piped in through our radios.
I said, Oakland is some kind of town, ain't it?
The Oakland Theatre Project planned this entire season around drive-in productions. William Thomas Hodgson is the nonprofit's co-artistic director.
This is something we could ask people to come to and still feel like we're keeping them safe.
Hodgson wants to get audiences out of their cars and into the theatre again, but there are some aspects to producing shows in a pandemic that he hopes will stick around, like paying actors a fairer wage. He says his company has been able to up their pay by 50% over last year. That's possible in a season like this one, where you're only hiring a handful or fewer of them per show.
We're committed to this, we're going to do it, but our mainstay at Oakland Theatre Project has been these large cast productions. I don't know what that looks like in the future.
What a great house tonight! What a wonderful crowd! We loved it! Nights like these are what we live for in the theatre.
Opera San Jose also hopes one day to return to big productions, but the pandemic has inspired the company to lean into producing one-act and chamber works like Three Decembers, with small casts and shorter shows. Corey Dastor is Opera San Jose's general director.
Shorter evenings reduce risk and help patrons feel more comfortable around pinch points. They make a lot of sense to welcome new audiences.
Dastor is investing heavily in digital tools and training, including offering video content translated into Spanish and Vietnamese. She says her audience is expanding as a result of these efforts, with several thousand new households tuning in this past year, versus around several hundred in previous years, both locally and from places as far-flung as Germany and Japan. But she recognises some traditional opera lovers might not be on board with the digital revolution.
My anxiety and concern is how long it takes for us to get to a model where the people we've lost because of our pivot are offset by the new people that are engaging with us for the first time.
The bi-coastal contemporary dance company Raw Dance has also been able to reach new audiences with virtual content during the pandemic. Like the recent video world premiere of The Healer, a work inspired in part by the COVID-19 pandemic. The piece explores humans' ability to overcome physical and emotional suffering through the theme of traditional Chinese medicine and holistic practices. Raw Dance co-artistic director Katerina Wong says her company has been working hard to adapt their three-dimensional art form to the two-dimensional screen.
How do we still create that sense of connection and intimacy and communication when so many of us are sitting and watching lots of Netflix or like on back-to-back Zoom calls?
Wong says producing high-quality video is expensive, especially for small dance companies like hers. Figuring out how to expand access to the art form without sacrificing the quality of live performances when they return is a major financial challenge her company now faces. Raw Dance relies on donations and grants for survival, including funding from the city of San Francisco. Wong wants to see more government support.
What feels so essential being located in these cities is that it's a signaling of the significance of artists in the community to be culture bearers and culture makers.
San Francisco's Board of Supervisors recently approved a more than $24 million budget appropriation this year to support local arts groups. This is to make up for the loss of one of the main sources of arts funding, the hotel tax. That revenue is down by nearly 90% since last year, and arts groups are worried about making it through.
The short-term prognosis is not good.
That's San Francisco-based indie band manager Jordan Kurland. He sits on the boards of several local arts nonprofits and says the Bay Area community isn't just desperate for local government support. They're also waiting for federal aid to materialize from the Save Our Stages Act, a $15 billion aid package signed into law last December.
And that is going to provide some relief, but the application process has not begun.
Yet the resilience and creativity he's seeing locally gives Kurland reason for hope. For starters, rents have been dropping in the Bay Area, whose real estate is among the most expensive in the country.
I think there's opportunity right now. I think that is a silver lining from the pandemic.
And he says as the region becomes more affordable, the local arts community will bounce back. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.